Yeah. Anyway, we continue, Rabotai. The Torah tells us that in Pasuk Yud Bet, Vayar Elohim et Ha'ares Ve'ine Nishhata Ki Yishhit Kol Basar Et Darko Al Ha'ares. The Pasuk says that, and God saw that the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. Now this pasuk is obviously redundant. It repeats itself twice. First it says that God saw that the earth was indeed corrupted because everybody on earth became corrupted. Well, that's obvious. Why does it have to say it twice? So I saw a beautiful explanation to this, to explain the pasuk. Who sets for us ethical values? Where do we get our the mores of our faith and the ethical laws and morality? Where's that standard set? Who decides that? Obviously, it's the Torah. Our morals and values are from a divine source. Now, if you don't choose a divine source for your set of ethical rules, then society is going to decide it. Then already each society will decide what is right and what is wrong and what is proper. Now, what happens is, after society accepts it, it no longer becomes a vice, or it no longer becomes immoral, because society accepts that this is what we do. So therefore you could have the most corrupt society, but they themselves don't think they're corrupt, because they socially accepted to live according to this standard. And therefore, when depravity becomes a lifestyle, that's the greatest corruption. It's one thing if a guy's living a corrupt life and he knows he's doing wrong. It's okay, you know, the guy, he can't control himself, maybe one day he'll come around. But when society is doing things where that became normal, that's the normal, and nobody even understands what's wrong with it, that is the greatest corruption. And that's what the pasuk says happened in the times of Noah. Vayar Elohim et ha'aretz ve'hineh nishhata, which means God saw that the land became corrupt. The problem was, it was only seen as corrupt in God's eyes. But ki yishhit kol basar et darko al ha'aretz, because on the earth, corruption became their derech. Corruption became their lifestyle, their way, and therefore they didn't even realize that they were doing anything wrong. They didn't realize that the corruption of stealing was wrong, and the immorality, and all the other vices that they were involved with promiscuity and lewdness. To them, they thought, this is normal. And therefore, God said, that's the crime over here. When the corruption is only seen in the eyes of God, He's the only one that's picking it up, and nobody else sees it, because that became darko, that became their way. Then already, that already is a time that society needs to be woken up and shaken to at its core. And this is exactly what's happening in our time as well. Which means today in our society, the corruption has become so common, and so for so many years a certain acceptance, so we lost already our sense of right and wrong. We don't even recognize anymore what's so bad about it. Which means, for example, if we talk about the immodesty. Today already, it's accepted for a lady to wear or not wear certain clothes. And that's accepted, which means, of course, even according to the immodest culture, there is a bar. But unless you go beneath that bar, it's considered fine. It's considered tasteful. Now, when society doesn't even recognize that the imam, when a lady's walking into a synagogue, half-dressed, and you tell her to put something on, she says, well, I'm fine. You don't even realize that you're immodest. You don't even realize that there's a problem over here. I mean, that has become so embedded in the lifestyle that the corruption can only be seen by God. But nobody else is seeing it. Then already we've reached the point of no return. Then already there's no hope. Then God has to just shake up the world to take us out of our slumber. And this is the same thing. You know, many years ago, the majority of society understood understood that Chas v'Shalom homosexuality was considered taboo, it was considered a haram, it was considered an aib, it was considered intolerable. However, as society now progresses or regresses, now already such tolerance has become for even such things where you say, all right, to each their own. Now already you're legalizing the corruption. Now you don't even realize that something corrupt about it. Well, he was born that way. This is what it is. You're live and let live.
Alternate.
And now already you have groups that want to come and alter the Torah and come along and say, well, the Torah doesn't appreciate the weaknesses here. And Chas v'Shalom, this is already one thing to have a corruption, but recognize it. But to come along and now say, you don't even see the corruption in them, you don't even see the problem anymore. Now, right, to come and legalize these things, that's exactly what happened in the times of Noah. In the times of Noah, the people, it says, we're going to the county clerk, getting kitubot for marriages between men and men. You think this is a problem that started in the year 2005 in the village somewhere? This starts over here in the times of Noah. The people were getting kitubot, marriage documents for men. When Borei Olam said, now they're legalizing it. I mean, they don't even realize now it's an issue. To them, this became a lifestyle. That already, this is corruption that has become now permissible. God says he cannot tolerate it. That's something in life we have to remember. And the only way one is able to be aware of right and wrong is when he studies Torah. The Torah is like a binoculars. The Torah is like a glass where you're able to see what is proper and what is not proper. But if a person doesn't have Torah, Hollywood will tell you this is accepted. Hollywood says it's accepted. They like it. It's okay. So it's considered normal. If Hollywood would tell you to walk around with a garbage bag over your head, then enough people would walk around with a garbage bag over their head. So you say, okay, that's the fashion this year. People walk around with a garbage head over their jeans. They're deciding for us. So therefore you're falling for it. That becomes normal. Yeah, but it's corruption. And if you have, a society where there's groups in this country that say that to legalize drugs. Because why not? Everybody's doing it anyway. And that became, a lifestyle. Therefore, why forbid it if everybody's doing it? Cigarettes are illegal. So therefore, go and legalize the drugs as well. This is already taking, you don't even recognize that it's corrupt anymore. You don't even realize what's wrong with it. That's everybody's question. A guy who's not religious, you can't do this. What's wrong with it? You don't even understand on your own what's wrong with certain things anymore. You don't understand that there's certain inherent problems in the way you're living. That's already the hashchata that we are discussing. Torah says earlier in our parasha about the mabul, that the imminent the flood wasn't so imminent. It was 120 years. It took Noah to build the Teva. And after Noah goes on the Teva, it says the flood was for 40 days and 40 nights. And the Mefarshim question, why does the flood have to be for 40 days and 40 nights? Why that number? Why not 30 days? God could have flooded the world in 1 second. He could have just brought one entire deluge that floods the world immediately. Why does it have to go for 40 days and 40 nights? So the Maharal over here has a very deep explanation. The Maharal says that we have a Torah law that says if somebody commits a certain transgression, a lota aser, he can get lashes. He can get malkut. Now the Torah says, arba'im yakenu. You give him 40 lashes. But the rabbis say it's not 40. It's really 39. That's a little strange. So that says 40, but the rabbis come along and interpret it 39. That five per bug, five sets per bug, like we learned in the Gemara. But the point is, Torah says 40, you give us 39. So he explains like this: where'd they get this anyan of 40 lashes? Because a human being is formed in his mother's womb. It takes 40 days to form the embryo. And therefore, when a person commits an avon, so that's already a form of spiritual death, and therefore he needs to be, so to speak, recreated. So therefore they give him the amount of lashes of 40, which symbolizes the creation of a new person. They punish him to bang out the old in order to recreate anew. Oh, so give him 40, the Maharal says. 40 is the magic number. So he says, no. He says it actually takes 39 days to form the physical body, and on day 40 they put the neshama in. And therefore, you don't need lashes for the neshama. The neshama didn't want to sin in the first place. The neshama is pure. So therefore, the 39 days are connected to 39 days of the creation of the physical part of the body. Once you recreate the physical, so the neshama already automatically is covered because it's in a new body. And therefore, the Torah says that the world now needed to be recreated. The world was corrupt. And therefore, just like when God creates a single embryo, it takes 40 days to recreate it. Now imagine the whole world was one big embryo. And therefore God had to create it again from start. So therefore the number 40 is significant. And now we can even go further. Why through water? Why couldn't God just, you know, burn the world? You know, they take a volcano and let it erupt and let all the lava go all over the world and burn it. Why specifically by water? So the explanation is like this. Because life in the embryo emerges from where? From water. The baby, the embryo is in the amniotic fluids, and therefore it comes out. Why does God make it like that? Because the fluid, human beings cannot exist in water. Which means, we're not fish. Even if you put a guy with a scuba tank, eventually it's going to run out and the guy's going to die. Our existence is on dry land. It's not in the water. And therefore, when God wants to recreate somebody, He puts him in an environment where he has no life, where he has no existence, and therefore when he emerges as new. And therefore the world had to be, so to speak, filled to the capacity with water, just like the embryo is in water, and after 40 days it emerges new to life, so too the world as one large embryo had to go through the same process. With this, we understand the creation of the world as well. If you remember in Parashat Bereshit, what the Pasuk say, V'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei hamayim. Originally in the creation of the world, the Spirit of God was hovering over the water, which means there was just one mass of water, and from there the world emerged. And now that we understand this, says Rav Samson of Farl Hirsch, you can understand the secret of mikveh. How does a mikveh work? First of all, what's the minimum measurement of a mikveh? 40 se'ah. Now you know why 40 se'ah, because when a person sins, why does a person have to go to a mikveh? Either because he comes in contact with tum'ah, right? He comes in contact with some type of something that is defiling, something that is tamer. Now all tum'ah has something to do with death. Every tum'ah has got something to do with death. Either a corpse, or even a nida. A lady that has nida, that's already a contact with death. How? Because when a lady is nida, she now technically is cannot create life during that period. Because now she's, the eggs are coming out. So since there's a temporary breakdown of the creation of life in the, so that's already a form of death. Because you cannot create life. So therefore there's a tum'ah that sets in. And therefore when a person receives tum'ah, the form of death, he has to recreate himself. So how does he recreate himself? He goes into a body of water of 40 se'ah, and he goes underneath it, and now when he emerges, he's in an environment that he cannot live for more than a few seconds. And now when he comes out, it's as if he's emerging from the embryo, from his mother's womb. It's like he goes back into the embryonic sac, which is the mikveh, and when he comes out, it's like he's born again. Therefore, the mikveh is a renewal. Therefore, the mikveh has the ability to refresh. And therefore, the world actually was submerged in one big mikveh. That's why it was water. It was as if God submerged the entire world into a mikveh for 40 days. And therefore, when the world finally dried up, the world was not the same. It was now purified. So that's a little of the depth of why the Torah chose water and why also it chose 40 days. Others explain why water was chosen as the vehicle of destruction. They explain it because one of the sins of the generation of the Mabul was thievery. but it was very, very like it was a, it was exactly, they used a loophole. They used the loophole. Yeah, non-incremental, non-incriminating stealing. How? They stole less than the prescribed measure that can be taken to court for. So everybody was taking a little, you know, so you can take a court, the guy stole 4 cents. So the maximum you could litigate is 5 cents. So each guy went to the fruit store, and they took, you know, 4 cents worth of fruit. So the guy said, hey, give me back my, hey, take me to court. I can't take you to court for 4 cents. The next guy came 4 cents, 4 cents. Meanwhile, the guy went bankrupt. The guy's nothing left, but each guy takes 4 cents. He can take nobody to court. So it was a trick the way they took it. So, and what was their claim? Their claim was, I only took 4 cents. You know, what do you want? You can't punish me for that. So Borei Olam brought a flood. Now, what is a flood? A flood basically is a compilation of raindrops. It's one drop and another drop and another drop. So Borei Olam says, when they flood, they're screaming, hey, flood, what are you screaming at? It's just one drop. Yeah, but one drop and then another drop, another makes a flood. The same thing. 4 cents here, 4 cents there, 4 cents there, you bankrupt the guy. So therefore it was a midah keneged, midah, in order to stop their, to go negate their claim of how they were stealing. Now, the Mefarshim do point out that, the world became so corrupted that even the animals, it says, ki yishrit kod basare tarkoa la'aris, even the animals became corrupted. The Beit HaNevi asks, you know, how can animals become corrupt? It's one thing human beings are corrupted. The animals don't have free will. So you tell me that the animals were cheating with each other and they were, you know, promiscuous. What does a kangaroo know from infidelity? He's born with certain, innate features, and he doesn't know what all these avonot are. We have yetzirah, they don't have. So the Beit HaNevi says a very important principle, and Yehuda Dopian also brings it down, that human beings, through their actions, they're able to either elevate the creation or they're able to bring down the creation. Which means, as if somebody sprays poison in the air, it's going to affect humans as well as the animals. And therefore, when human beings sin and they steep into degeneracy, that already affects all of the creation. So therefore, if you see the animals are immodest or acting in a not normal life, let's start with the animals. That means it trickled down already from the human beings. Ki yishrit kol basar et darko. Now, yeah, Seb.
About 15 years ago, the New York Times, an article about people that study birds.
Tell them this.
Birds that normally cohabit, male and female. In San Francisco, they found an anomaly that the male birds were on one tree and the female birds were on another tree.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing.
Where do you hear that from? Where
that's why San Francisco specifically? Yeah. No, I'm joking about it. I know. I know that exactly. And interesting, they did a similar study. They found the birds in Williamsburg, each one of them had 15 children.
Right. Don't figure.
In any event,
should I write these notes down?
You don't got to write Sammy's Divrei Torah down. You just have to write my stuff down. In any event, you see over here, Rabotai, the power of human beings, how they influence the Bidi'ah. And the opposite would also be true. When a human being infuses Kiddushah in a certain spot, so that already benefits him and can elevate the entire world. I recently read a story of a few hundred years ago of a fellow that had to say Kaddish. So he found himself in a certain synagogue, and he sat in a certain spot, and he prayed, and he said his Kaddish. And he felt very inspired in the tefillah. He says, I never felt such a kiddushah in the tefillah. So he asked the people of the synagogue that are the regulars, wow, what a synagogue this is. This is a, you know, I pray every day, but I felt something special today. So he says, happens to be the seat that you're sitting in, there's a tradition that the Gaon Mevilna sat in this seat and prayed. So, you know, you happen to strike on an oil well. You know, you sat in the seat where the Kiddushah of the Gaon Mevilna was invested. So you see, there is some type of inyan where a place of Kiddushah can affect, other people even years later. The Chazon Ish once on a Friday night was walking, and he stopped. He said, oh, you can still smell it. So they came to the guy. What are you talking about? He says, this afternoon, some of the boys at the Panovich Yeshiva were talking the Vrei Torah in this exact spot. So the Hazonish, Friday night, when he was walking, he says, you can still feel the fragrance of the Kiddushah of the Torah. So if you have a sensitive soul, you can actually tap into the Kiddushah. The Rav Chanan Vasseman, Hashem Yimkum Davar, was once driving in a car. And he was driving through Times Square in Manhattan, and the guy in the car, his head was down, he wasn't looking, he's not a tourist, Rav Chanan Vasseman. And as he was driving through, he started to say, oh, it stinks here, keep on going, drive through, what's going on over here? So you see, obviously he sensed that in Times Square that it's not Me'asharim, it's not one of the holier places in the... I'm not talking about the new Times Square. The new Times Square is just the new Gehinnom. It's like the old Gehinnom and the new Gehinnom. Didn't change. It's the same thing, but they call it the new. They didn't make it more. They didn't make it kadosh. It's the same garbage. So when they went through, he was already able to sense it. I recently read a story where Palmer brings it down in the Sefer of a fellow. He mentions his name, a wealthy guy that once made a parlor meeting for the Lakewood Yeshiva. And he invited one of his neighbors. The guy's like Mehalel Shabbat, but he has some money, so I'll invite him to the parlor meeting. So he comes to the parlor meeting, and it happens to be Rav Aaron Cutler spoke at the meeting. Okay. So Rav Aaron gets up, and he gives a whole complicated shiur to the layman on the laws of tzedakah, that if you donated money to one place, now you want to switch it. This whole Gemara, he gave a whole deep dissertation on the laws of tzedakah. And this Mahalil Shabbat, just looking at Rav Aaron Cutler, after he finishes the speech, the guy makes his donation, he walks out, and he tells the host, he says, I will never be the same person after that speech. So, he told him, you understood what he said? You know, most of the guys who learned couldn't follow. Rav Aaron Cutler had lightning speed thoughts. He was able to build very quickly, and he was able to go, you understood it? He said, of course I understood. He says, what was he saying? He was saying, how come you're a Mehalel Shabbat? He says, hey, wait a minute, he's a Mehalel Shabbat. He didn't talk about Shabbat. But the man, because Rav Aaron had such kiddushah when he spoke, so in that area, in that zone, became filled with Kiddushah, where this guy, just looking at the rabbi and hearing the Devarei Torah coming out, it started to penetrate. He says, I don't know, he was telling me, why am I not Shomer Shabbat, I'm not keeping code. I mean, all the things that he wasn't doing, he understood all of a sudden as if he was woken up. Even the rabbi didn't talk about it at all. That's already the ability, when one does the right thing, when one has Kiddushah, you're able to bring many people around by it. But when one Chas V'Shalom infuses Averot into the world, they're going to punish us not only for our sins, but we make it much easier for the next guy to sin. Because if the environment is poisoned, we're putting the next guy at a disadvantage. Because now, he already smells the tumah, and therefore he becomes more liable to sin. And that's exactly what happened in the times of Noah. The people committed such an avon, and that already affected the society that they were. And that already is the lesson of Ki Yishchit Kol Basar Et Darko Al Ha'aretz. Furthermore, in the Perasha,
Rabbi, can I ask you a question?
Please, of course.
Why in Sodom and Gomorrah, when things were bad like this, I think they used a different method. It was fire or something to destroy.
Yes, it was destroyed with fire.
Water to destroy. But at least, why destroy the whole world? Why couldn't they just have it centrally located to the area that was bad, like they did in Sodom and Gomorrah? They didn't destroy the whole world.
So what it seems is like this.
Why that? Whole world had to be correct. Maybe in China we're good or something.
Right. No, first of all, it says that the whole world was corrupted. You have to remember the world was not as we know it today. Mm-hmm. I mean, Christopher Columbus didn't come till 1492 and discover America. So I don't know how many Indians you had on this side of the globe at the time of the flood. But the point is, whatever place was inhabited was destroyed. Because since the Tum'ah was in the world, the Tum'ah travels. Which means when there's a poison, if there's a nuclear bomb in one spot, it's going to affect 300 or 3,000 miles away. You're going to get, like in Chernobyl, when they had that nuclear leak or that explosion, it affected thousands of miles away in Russia. Why? Because the poison is out. So therefore God had to destroy not only the local place where the disease was, but the whole place became infected. So you had to purge the whole entire world. Now, in the case of Sodom, God might have destroyed the whole world again. But he vowed in the times of Noah that he's not going to destroy the world a second time. So therefore, it was a localized event. Sodom and Amorah were destroyed, but it was a major event. It was five major cities that were totally decimated without any survivors, less Lot and his family. So therefore, since God vowed not to destroy the whole world again, and it seems outside of Sodom there wasn't too much corruption, so it didn't warrant it. Here, there was no place. Lest Noah and his family, the whole world went crazy. The whole world went wild. Fair question. Furthermore, in the Perasha, we read, interesting, look at Perek Het Pasuk Tet Vav. Let's see if we can make sense of this one over here. Perek Het Pasuk Tet Vav. Easy, right? What does it say? God tells Noah, "Tse min ha-teba." He says, "Get out of the teba. Leave the teba. Ata v'shtecha banecha, unche banecha etach. Take your wife, your children, their wives." Page 38. Next pasuk says, "Kol ha-haya asher etecha mikol basar bov be'ma kol revus ha-remes ha-la'ares ha-yitze itach." So he tells him again, all the animals that are on the teba with you, and all the crawling creatures and all that other stuff, haitze itach, take out with you. So let's look at Rashi over. I think Rashi has a comment here. Rashi says, "Well, you see the problem with this word here?
Yeah.
It says hotze. It's written hotze, but we read it haitze. What is the difference between hotze or haitze?" Rashi Yudzayin, hotze ketiv, haitze kari, but we read it haitze. Haitse amud lahem sheyitzu. Haitse means tell the animals they could leave. Hotse im enam rotzim latzet, hotziem otam. If they, exactly. But if they don't want to leave, you have to force the animals to get off the teba. So therefore there's two words over here, depending on the animal's opinion, if they want to get off or not. If they want to get off the teba, beautiful. If they don't want to get off the teba, force them off. So, we see over here a very interesting subject. Why should the animals refuse to get off the ark? Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the conditions on the Teba were hardly ideal. As we mentioned last night in the Shi'ud, I mean, the Teba was very cramped quarters. You're living with all the animals. You know, you don't have open space, the wilderness, an animal needs its, area to roam. And here it's living with all the jungle next to him and the noise and the smell and all that. Why would an animal decide to stay and not return to the free outdoors? So maybe the Torah over here is trying to teach us a lesson. Now, every pasuk has a lesson here, which means, why would the Torah and Nashi especially have to go out of his way and say, if they want to go off, what do I care what the animals care? Let them go off, let them not go off. That doesn't do anything to me. The Torah is a guidebook for us. If the Torah is telling us this condition of the animals' hesitancy to go off the Teba, must be that there's some lesson that we can apply to the human condition. And the Mefarshim explain that sometimes when people fall into a rut, or let's say into a certain type of depression, so a lot of times they opt to remain in the rut because they become accustomed to it. Rather than better the circumstances, change and try to get out of it, and they get used to a certain way and they become comfortable. And the logic is because people loathe to make changes. People get used to anything, and they don't want to rock, and they don't want to change anything. Even though there's obvious advantages for them to get out of the rut and to better themselves, but they fall into a certain level of comfortability. Even though they can have more fulfillment, the comfort overweighs it, instead of progressing and improving. And therefore the animals over here could be, listen, we're good, we have food over here in the Teba, We have, you know, shelter. Noah's taking care of us. We have a room. We have board. Everything's okay. So who needs progress and who needs improvement? So therefore, God tells Noah, if the animals are going to feel like that, you're going to have to force them off. Now, obviously, man is greater than an animal. And therefore, man is not at liberty to resign himself to circumstances, no matter how comfortable he is. And therefore, a person always has to strive for growth, especially when it comes to religion. A person comes and says, I'm good. Leave me alone. I'm happy what I'm doing. It's working. I do exactly what it is. Don't do more. You're not an animal. We're already having the, you could make a decision where you want to say, I want to stay at a certain level. Human beings have to constantly be willing to adapt and willing to change and willing to grow. And therefore the Torah is telling you, if Noah told the animals, even if you want to, I'm forcing you out. But the Olam tells the human being, you have no option just to remain where you are. Whether it's in a depression or whether it's in a situation, you always have to try to progress and try to achieve and try to grow. Last but not least, we have one more time for Dvar Torah here. The last point we'll say over from the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, which is a novel interpretation of the Migdal of Babel. At the end of the parasha, we read about the Dor HaPalaga, when they built that tower to God, all the way up in the heavens. And it says God came down and mixed their languages up, and they started fighting with each other, and it became a whole debacle, and he destroyed them. So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh asked the obvious question. What was their sin? I mean, where is there an Isur to build a high-riser? I mean, all they did is they built a skyscraper. It's the first skyscraper ever recorded in history. And Torah comes along and says, what a avon. What sin? It doesn't say anything more than that. So they were involved in construction. So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says like this. No, there was a philosophy behind this building. They wanted to oppose the design of God, the way he created the world. How? The Or HaChaim says, God created the world one-third water, one-third wilderness, and one-third inhabit. One-third of the world is inhabited. That's the way God wanted it. He wanted to have water and uninhabited land, and then civilization. But to be spread out on one-third of the land. Now, one-third of there's a lot of real estate. It's a lot of land for the amount of people that are around. Which means, technically, if we would split it up proportionately, everybody can get, you know, at least a few acres. We don't choose to live like that, because we choose to live where we want to live, but God gave enough real estate of one-third for, I don't care, the billions of people that are in the world, for each guy to take a few acres and live comfortable. What did they say? They came along, and this was the first urban development. They came along and said, no, we have a better idea. Why everybody live all scattered? Let's all come and live in one city. Now, if everybody's going to live in one city, you have to build high rises, because you can't live horizontally. You have to live vertically.
Okay.
You have to live up, because there's no room. So they went, they decided, we're going to build a condominium. This was the first turn, before Turnberry. The first Turnberry was Migdal Babel. So they went, instead of calling it Aventura, they called it Migdal Babel. And they went and they put a big building up. Lavdil, of course. And they put a big building. I said, well, we'll live together. We'll live as one. It's the first tenement apartment that they built. But they were going against God's divine design. God says it's not healthy when everybody's crowded and lives all together. And what ended up happening, since they went against God's plan, it worked against them. A people that were united and were happy and were working together and were comfortable, all of a sudden, they became violent with each other. They became very nervous with each other. There was no communication. It says they were fighting and they were... What happened? Because God says man needs space. And therefore, you think, I don't know why I gave you one-third land? For a reason. So you coming along, you know better. You know better. We know. We're going to put everybody in one section. Look at the power. Everybody's in one area. What ended up happening? They started killing each other. And therefore, they didn't have the capacity to understand one another. And this is, over here, Rabotai, a lesson for us, the dangers of population congestion, which means we didn't have too much of a choice, but this is the way we live. Now, we could have lived in Wyoming, and each guy could have 50 acres, and you don't see a guy for 6 months, there's no civilization. Instead, we chose, or our lot has brought us to the most congested area, probably in the world, besides maybe some cities in China or in the Far East. We live in New York, and that's already, the Torah is telling you, we have the dangers. Because the dangers of a congested life is people start to lose sensitivity to others because it becomes very competitive. Because now we need that parking spot. You know, in Wyoming, you never have to fight for a parking spot. Because, you know, there's miles of empty road. But over here, if you don't get that spot, somebody else is going to get it, and therefore it's going to cost you half hour. So therefore we become, you know, callous to the sensitivity of others. Or whether it's, you know, we're building a house, there's a guy next door, and he comes along and says, we're right on top of each other. It's not like, you know, you have, in Wyoming never happened where a guy built his house, a ranch, and the guy next door built a ranch, and the guy calls up the building department and says, you're blocking my son. You're blocking, whose son is it? Your son became your son all of a sudden. But in New York, this happens every single day. A guy comes along in there for a couple of feet. This is what happens over here. Because why? The space already is limited. So, right? The space already is limited. So now already you want to take more of my space? Yeah. So these are the tests that we are faced with. A guy living in another area, in the village or in the farm, doesn't have the test that we have. So you have to be concerned that living in the city, you could always tell who lives in the city, who lives in the, you know, the people who live in New York are very fast paced, they're very, very quick, they have little patience, very, guy out of town and right away you see the way he talks and his attitude. You go into his store at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, we're closed. Well, you're closed. I'm here, I want to buy something, I'll come back tomorrow. It's a different mentality. One time when I went for one of the summer vacations to the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. So we were in one of these resort areas, and we're driving, an open road, unbelievable, in the Rocky Mountains. There's 1,000 miles in front of you, there's 1,000 miles, there's nothing, it's zero, you own the state. So we're driving, and you're on vacation, you're not speeding, you're driving 30, 40 miles, you're looking at the scenery. All of a sudden, a guy comes behind me. He's tailgating me for 10 minutes. The guy's tailgating. This guy tailgating me. He's got open road here with a guy. You can't imagine. If you look like from the Google Earth, you'll see the whole state of Colorado and just open air, two cars within 3 inches of each other. What are you doing? What are you doing? I want to kill the guy. So I'm telling my wife, Sandra, for sure this guy's from New York. It's impossible that an out-of-towner could be doing this for so long. And the guy's bribing me. And he's like, we're doing our vacation. Stinko, where are you going? Sure enough, we turn into the resort area. Sure, this guy also turns up there. It's some guy from New York also that's on the trip. And they said, what are you doing? What are you doing? He says, I'm sorry. This is the way we drive in Brooklyn. This is the way we drive. You got to get the edge. You got to get these. He says, and his wife was telling him, what are you doing? Were you too close to the car? Leave him alone. He's like, you get used to that. So that's already the disadvantages of living on top of each other. That being said, it just brings out a competitiveness. But that being said, I will conclude that there is advantages about living the way we live. A few weeks ago, some out-of-towners came to the community for a Shabbat, and they were amazed. They prayed in 4 different synagogues, and there was 4 Sebets in 4 different synagogues where hundreds of Jews were celebrating and enjoying the Shabbat. People walking in the streets to synagogue, from the synagogue, shirurim and all the different batei kenesiyot, a whole menu of things you could do on Shabbat, b'kedushah u'tahorah, and it was a very big inspiration. This is where I come from. You know, we get a minyan on Shabbat, it's very, very humdrum, very boring. If we make a kiddush once a year, you know, we have a special Shabbat. Here it's Shabbat is like it's like the king. The king is coming to town. Everybody's excited. You see everybody dressed in their finery. So you see, there is an advantage when people are doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's an unbelievable inspiration to see everybody doing. So you have to take the advantages of living in a congested society and keep away from the disadvantages. The advantages when people are doing the mitzvot, it's power. You become motivated by seeing everybody learning and going. There's classes everywhere you go, in synagogue, etc. But there's also this advantage of, it brings out sometimes the animal in the person. That's what happened to the Migdal Babel. They built the first high rise and they thought they're going to rediscover, you know, the wheel, reinvent the wheel. And what ended up happening? They lost their sense to communicate with each other, and they became very feisty with each other, and that was their downfall. God created the world with divine. There's a reason why He made the world very big, in order to give people their space. Let this be a lesson with our children also. As they start growing up, children also need their space. Which means they need their. I'm not saying you have to build them their own room, and they have their own bathroom, and their own, you know, their own driveway. But also have to recognize that as people get a little older, they need a little more air space to breathe and to have their privacy, etc. Otherwise, sometimes it can be very negative. Baruch Adonai Olam. Amen. Amen.